What, just briefly, happy with your window, Ollie?
Happy?
Mm-hmm.
Delighted, yeah, absolutely.
I'm delighted now.
Yeah, delighted. way beyond what I thought they would do. And so you've got to be pleased with that. You've got to be pleased that they've gone. I didn't expect them, for instance, to go and get a left back, and I'm more than happy that they went and got Reguilon. Obviously, I would have been, the icing on the cake would have been to get a centre back. But, you know, I think they can get by with what they've got. I have my doubts about Dyer. I think for some reason, Mourinho's, yeah?
Doubts? I mean, that's been nice.
Well, yeah. I think Mourinho, for whatever reason, he sees him as like this John Terry type, you know what I mean? And I'm not seeing it. But yeah,
he's got to find one at every club, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, I think he thinks he's got all the attributes to be another John Terry, and I'm not convinced about that. He just can't stay, he can't concentrate for the full 90, you know what I mean? But yeah, I don't know. I think that even with that, the signings they've made is way beyond what I thought would happen.
Yeah.
I thought maybe get three in. But to go and get a left back as well as a right back, you know, Højbjerg and Bale as well, I think is, you know, it's a great window. They've done well.
Top four, yeah?
Yeah, I fancy it, yeah. I absolutely
fancy it. Well,
absolutely fancy it. A few weeks ago, I was telling you fifth, but now I'd fancy it big time. Yeah, yeah.
George, what are you saying? Top four now? You got Partey? You should be winning the league, right?
I stand by what I said. If we get a serious midfielder, top four's a wrap. So top four's a wrap.
Wow.
Boy, this is going to be a big top four, isn't it?
You get straight with Partey. Is Partey a defensive player or a box-to-box player?
You know, this is the thing. He's down as a defensive midfielder. But, Ollie, for me, he's a midfielder. He can do everything. He can get forward because he's got a great engine. He can defend. He's strong. He's got his passing range is really, really good, short and long. He's a midfielder. you know what I mean? Like the true word of a midfielder. A bit like Essien, but they say better. You know what I mean?
Whoa.
That's a big call.
I don't want to call him a defensive midfielder because I think that would be doing him a disservice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's not great at anything, but he can do everything, if that makes sense.
So when he's good to go, who is his partner? Who is his most likely partner?
I think it depends on the system, isn't it? But I think there's two formations that Arteta's going to play. It's either going to be a 3-5, if you like, 3-5-2, and a variation of that, or he'll go for a 4-3-3. A 4-3-3, I think he sits at the anchor, and then I just think he'll have Ceballos and Xhaka in front of him. In a 2, I think it's him. I would play him and Xhaka. I'd play him and Xhaka. And a lot of people, Xhaka's, hands up, Xhaka's won me back. He's won me
back.
Yeah. And I may live to regret those words. This is the recording right now. But I was tentative about keeping him this summer. I would have sold him this summer. But Arteta seems to really got him not doing dumb things. He's not doing dumb things anymore. And that was my main thing with him. He constantly did stupid things.
Yeah.
Dumb fouls and gave the ball away.
Penalties.
Huh?
Giving away penalties.
But dumb ones. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Just stupid ones. And he's not doing that anymore. And he seems to, the dressing room seems to respect him. So I'm gonna get mugged off this weekend when he gets sent off. I would play him and I'll play the two of them in a two. People say, oh, there's no creativity then because you take out Ceballos. But listen, I'm all about being hard to beat now.
So when you talk about a two, you're talking about a 3-4-3, yeah?
I'm talking about if he goes for a 4-2-3-1.
Right.
Or a 4-3.
He doesn't play that though. Doesn't he play a 3-4-3?
Oh, you know what? He plays everything. He's very Pep-like. So he'll start with a 3-4-3 and then he'll turn to a 3-5-2 and then he'll go, whatever.
So you could do the double. You could do the double pivot and put Ozil on number 10 then.
Shut up.
let him win.
Earlier on, before I come to your window, G. Earlier when I heard that apparently Ozil was offered full pay of his contract if he left, and he turned it down.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
He wants to stay there with that dinosaur, that Arsenal dinosaurus guy, doesn't he? He's not having it.
I heard today that he got a loyalty payment. Is that true?
Oh, I don't know. I've been out all day today, but
he got a loyalty payment of £8 million.
The dinosaurus got Ozil.
Huh? Ozil, of course. It's not going to be Goonosaurus, is it? So that would be why he didn't take he's taking the money, isn't he? He's taking you for all the money he can get.
Fair play to him. G, happy window?
Yeah, I am, you know. I think the problem is everyone's reactionary. So we've started badly. So everyone's like, oh, Lampard doesn't know what he's doing with all the players and the window wasn't as great as people thought it was.
Is that a shot at me, G?
No, that's just general talk. I mean, maybe some of your peers on the show. but to be honest, we haven't really had all of the signings together in one lineup yet. In most sense, we've pretty much had the same team as last year, like Ad Werner. So, I can't wait for this weekend and next weekend to kind of see how the team starts to gel together. But overall, I think the signings are really good. Like, I couldn't have asked for... I don't think a more productive window is realistic for us. I think we've addressed all the areas that we wanted to address and more. So, yeah, top four. We'll see how it goes.
I was going
to
say, it's top four on then, yeah?
No, I think we should... I think, you know, we should aim higher than top four, to be honest with you. I think we should...
When you spend that kind of money, you should.
Yeah. You should. I don't think... I don't think City don't look great and Aguero is out. So that there's... I mean, I know we said aim for City last year and that didn't work out quite nice for me, but I think you should, you know, you've always got to look up. We got top four last year, so just aiming for top four this year would have been a progression. I've got half a team in, so yeah, I'm not going to put any boundaries on it.
I think second's up for grabs personally. But
Seriously ask you though, G, would you, if you were scouring the Europe, right, for a centre-back,
yeah,
who would kind of push you forward, take you forward from where you were last season, would you seriously go for Thiago Silva?
No, I would have went for Upamecano, or however you put it. I know I've probably butchered his name. But I think the thing is we were desperate to sell at least one centre-back. We even considered sending it to you. And no buyers came in.
Who? Rudiger?
Yeah, we considered selling Rudiger to you for a little while from what I heard.
I don't think I ever seriously considered that. That was never going to happen.
I think if you guys had paid the money rather than took the loan, I think we would
have... What do you think's happened there with Rudiger? He's your best centre-half.
Yeah, it's one of those things where outside of the club, everyone thinks he's our best centre-half. And maybe before last year, I would have agreed. But he was just as bad as anyone else last year. In fact, maybe even worse. And he's got 2 years left on his contract. So it just makes sense to be. And he's the one that people are actually coming in for. I mean, no one wants Christensen. I'm sure if someone wanted Christensen, we'd be happy to release him. But no one wants him, you know. And we've got to recoup some of the money back.
All right, guys. Let's move on. This is the Football Fans Podcast with me, Jordan, Jarrett, Brian. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. Share the ting. We're across all the platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. And follow us on Audio Boom as well. I'm joined by Chelsea fan G and Spurs fan Ollie. We're going to be talking in the second half of the podcast about Man United, because I'm still loving it. And we'll be joined by the broadcaster and Man United fan, Hugh Woozencroft, as well.
Why not Marvin? Sorry to interrupt, but where's Marvin?
Well, it's not Marvin's week, so he lucked out that this is like this week off, you know what I mean? Ollie, don't worry. There's plenty of weeks to come.
You should have brought him on just for the joke.
Don't worry. There's plenty of juice in this box left. Don't worry. Marvin will get his turn on United Chat. So we'll get Hugh on it just a little bit later. We're going to be talking about defending before we get to that. But just before we do get to that, I just want to briefly touch on the two big stories that broke over the weekend. And we will do a whole podcast on these two things. I think they deserve a whole show. But we can't not touch on these two issues. The first one, the news broke, I think it was the end of last week, that Sky Sports and BT Sports are going to be charging football fans for extra matches that they haven't factored in into their package. They are the Premier League's two main broadcasters, and they're looking at this pay-per-view service that's going on. It'll be an extra selection of top-flight games, and I mean top-flight, I'd put in inverted commas there. They'll be screened at an extra cost. And the live games won't form part of the current package, as I've just mentioned there. And each game will cost £15 to view from 17th of this month. I mean, one of the first games I've got down here is Man United's trip to Newcastle, which is like, boy, I don't think even Man United fans can be paying for that, the way their team's going on right now. So I want to kick off with that. Just get your brief thoughts, guys, on the idea that that they're going to be charging for extra games. They say that they couldn't maintain this free football forever. But as football fans, start with you, G, what are your initial thoughts?
I think it looks and feels really bad, and add that to the news that's come on, that the other news that you talked about. It overall just leaves a bad taste in the mouth. They could absolutely afford to go, to offer free football, and it's not even free because you're still paying for Sky subscription. So, and a lot of clubs have actually taken season ticket money for this year anyway. So they could absolutely have afforded to go without charging extra money, it's extra £15 a month. It feels bad. It's not even value for money. Like, you could get, like, you used to be able to get boxing, like a whole card of boxing for £15 a night, you know what I mean? So I'm going to pay £15 for the games that you can't be bothered to put on TV. So you can imagine that, like how much, if I did every single game, that's probably like half my Sky subscription for the year. You know what I mean? I just think it's a total rip-off, and like, yeah, just not happy with it at all. I think football did some good work when the virus first came, but it seems if they're doing all they can to kind of revel that back, and that become quite poor, and yeah, not happy with either bits, to be honest.
Ollie, there's been a lot of backlash to this. People are vexed, pundits, football fans, and beyond. But this was tweeted by Enialuko when the announcement came out. Genuine question. If the average price of a Premier League ticket live is £30 plus, why is the pay-per-view price of £14.50 for watching the same product on the pitch seen as an outrageous final straw? Is this actually something that people are vexed about because we've been used to getting it for free? Are we vexed because we're currently paying for a package already? Or are we forgetting that we're getting a premium sporting package, and if there's extra games to view, it's £14 in the grand scheme of things isn't an outrageous thing to ask for?
I just, as G says, I don't really understand what the justification is for asking for more money from fans. I don't get it. What are we saying here? Are we saying that the Premier League can't afford to offer these matches free as they have been doing up until now? I don't really understand what their justification is for this. Because in the end, you know, the Premier League, we've just come out of the transfer window and the Premier League clubs are still spending money, you know, like they always have done. So there hasn't been much in terms, you know, in terms of the optics of all this, as G was saying, it looks terrible because you've got a situation where, you know, you look at what's happened at your club, Jordan, and, you know, one day you're getting rid of Gunasaurus. The next day, you're signing Partey for £45 million. You know, how does that work? And, you know, my club's not immune from it. All the business with putting people on, trying to put people on furlough and all the rest of it, it's terrible. At the start of lockdown, that looked terrible and they should never have tried to do that. When you've got a situation where you can't go to your players and say, listen, this is the situation as it stands, we need to cut back here. If we're in serious trouble, we need to cut back here. We can't be paying players, you know, 200 grand a week or whatever it is. So I don't understand how they kind of keep thinking that they can keep you know, rifling through the pockets of the fans, asking for more money when we're already paying for a Sky subscription, we're already paying for BT subscription, you know, and on top of that, as season ticket holders, Spurs have taken some money out of me for, you know, for games that I can't even go to, you know, so what more do you want from fans? You know, they clearly are able to do better. And I don't think any Aluko's point makes any sense. Just because you can do it, just because the money, you know, that the fans pay a certain amount of money for the live experience, that doesn't mean that we're in this position as we stand now. And you can just turn around and say, well, you know, if you were going to a live match and it would cost you this much, it doesn't work like that. And on top of that, you know, in terms of the health conditions as well, it's not a good idea, is it? Because what's going to end up happening is that people are going to turn around and say, well, we'll all go round to X's place and watch the game, which is not what you're supposed to be doing, is it? Because people aren't going to pay for that. So people are going to end up then going, more people are going to end up going to the pub, or more people are going to end up going to their mate's place or wherever they want to watch it because they don't want to pay. How does that work in terms of, you know, of people staying at home? You should be trying to, make people try, you know, stay at home during these times and watch the game on their own or watch the game with a small group.
I think we will develop this a bit more in another pod, but I think that I take your points, but they've done the maths and they've probably worked out that we can probably get 50,000, maybe 100,000 people that will pay for this. Do the maths. If 100,000 people in the UK pay £14.95 each, that's decent money. So they're probably thinking that they're going to piss off a lot of people, but there's a decent amount of money to be made on the side of it as well. But we'll see.
I agree with that. But then I think that, you know, that's where football fans, you don't have to pay this money. You know, football fans have got to turn around and say, well, no, there's got to be a point where you can't keep taking the piss out of us like this. This isn't right. Yeah. So I don't think, you know, football fans have got to stand up in this respect and turn around and say, no, we're not paying that. That's the only way that these clubs will realise that it's not an endless stream for them where they can just keep knocking on the door and asking for more money.
No. The other big story that broke, just again briefly, guys, yesterday, it's been dubbed the biggest scoop in football, or the biggest story in the Premier League for two decades. It's a proposal from the Big Six. They've put in
from two, from what I heard.
Yeah, maybe.
Is it from United and Liverpool?
It sounds like it. Yeah, a proposal that Man United and Liverpool have led the charge to try and save and restructure the pyramid of English football. It's been, again, heavily criticised. For those that don't know the story, it's a proposal that includes so many takeaways and talking points, from cutting the amount of numbers of teams in the Premier League from 20 to 18, axing the League Cup and the Community Shield, revised top-flight promotion and relegation, new format to finances, and a whole new democracy, if you like, of how and who runs the game in this country. I don't personally, and again, we can't really go into it just briefly, guys, this week, but we'll go into it more in depth on another show. I don't personally think that the entire proposal is all negative. Do you guys think this is very opportunistic and it's bang out of order and be rejected? Or do you think there's things that are worth considering? Go on, you go first, Ollie.
Well, as I said to you earlier before we started, you know, it's a bit like politicians do this all the time. The Tories do this all the time. Throw something out there and knowing full well that it's not going to fly, but then they just throw something out there to see what the reaction is and see what's, you know, how it's going to be received. And so while these clubs probably don't expect anything to come of this, you kind of think, well, they've chosen this moment during an international break. They know no one's going to be talking about anything else. So, you know, it's a good opportunity for them to put it out there. And even if it doesn't fly, it's just giving people a little idea of what's coming down the track. Because somewhere down the line, this kind of, something approaching this will happen. You know, I think that, as you said, Jordan, there are some good proposals in there. There are some things that I have to admit that I kind of agree with, actually. Parachute payments and things like that, which I think are totally unfair. I think, you know, if they turn around and said, right, okay, all of the EFL clubs are going to get this amount of money, 25% of revenues, I don't think that's a bad idea. But my concern is that this could be the thin end of the wedge, especially when you're dealing with two clubs who are American-owned, who are looking at a situation where, you know, they want more power in voting rights, but they also probably want to get to a situation where they can never get relegated, yeah. You know, and there's no relegation out of the Premier League. So you've got a situation a bit like what they know in America. So I think this will just be the starting point of something, of a place that they want to get to. And that's where I have my doubts about it. But I do think that there are some proposals in there. Rather than just rubbishing it all, I think there's some proposals in there really are worth discussing and talking about at length.
G, Rich, briefly, what was your initial reaction when you saw this story?
Yeah, I didn't really like any of it, to be honest with you. And even the things, there are a few things like the parachute payments that you mentioned that make sense. But I don't like it under the context of, well, take this money and then we'll do that. But then also you'll give us back some power when you do it as well. I want the Rumbelows Cup to remain. I don't want that to go out of the disaster. I want that to be there. I think 20 clubs in the Premier League, I don't see why we would reduce it to 18, to be honest with you. I don't see that at all. The main good thing about it is they've actually shown their hand and said, okay, we can give 250 mil to the clubs. Okay, do that. If you want to restructure things, there'll be plenty of time to restructure things. But don't try to give them like the, you know, a sweetener to do it, which basically rocking them to sleep. Because that's exactly what will happen. Eventually, this rule of six or rule of nine or whatever it is will eventually just mean that all the power goes to those clubs and then the rest of the clubs suffer for it. Mm-hmm. And it's almost, I mean, I take Ollie's point totally that they know it would never have flown. But then to actually think that if they actually thought that we're so stupid that we couldn't see what was happening through this, like it's almost insulting.
Yeah, I tend to agree with what you both said. I think though that they realise that the EFL is in big trouble and they're vulnerable. And as much as I don't think it will happen, I don't think it's a dead cert that it won't happen. I think when you're on the floor on your knees, boy, you might have to do a deal with the devil. But we'll see, and we'll get into that in future.
I've said to you before, though, Jordan, the EFL are their own worst enemies.
I agree with that as well.
You know, we've had this conversation before. Yeah. I said to you quite a long time ago, the EFL let Bury go under. They're not, you know, they don't look after their own house, let alone, you know, I'm not saying that the split in terms of money the Premier League get is right. But the fact that the EFL let a club like Bury go under, you think, well, there must have been ways that you could have helped them. And, you know, you've got the guy who's running the EFL basically turning around and saying, not just that, you know, we're gonna change, you know, the way that it works, but also you're gonna lose two clubs from the EFL as well. Have you actually got the best intentions of the EFL in mind here? You're basically saying that two clubs are gonna go back down to the National League and it's gonna be 90 rather than 92 clubs.
Yeah, it's bad.
He's agent for Liverpool.
Yeah, it doesn't look good as far as he's concerned, because he's out there kind of promoting this thing, and Liverpool and Man United are saying absolutely nothing. Yeah. You know, which looks even worse. I just think, you know, he should be taking a step back. He should have said one thing about it, given a statement and left it there. But the fact that he's going around doing the rounds on the media about this, I just think, mate, that's a bit irresponsible, because not only are you basically doing the job of Liverpool and Man United, but you're basically saying that you're all right with the EFL just losing two clubs just like that. Which, what EFL club is going to agree to that?
I've got to move, guys. So let's talk defending. It's been documented this season that there's been an insane amount of goals for the first month of the Premier League. There hasn't been a 0-0 yet this season. And I think the standard of defending for the best part of 5, maybe even 10 years has been a talking point amongst many supporters of Premier League clubs in particular. last weekend was obviously a madness with what happened with Liverpool, Villa, United and Spurs. But just generally, there's been, even the week before, Leicester went to City and scored five on City's patch. What does it say about the current state of defending when the so-called two best teams in the country can concede five goals 1 week, seven goals the next week, and on the same weekend, a record central defender at Old Trafford is part of a defence that concedes six?
Yeah, I think what it says is the standard of defending has dropped over time.
Why? What I want to know is why.
Why? I blame the 2000s. Well, to start off with the 2000s in terms of the Benitez and the Mourinho's era, where football was a lot really reactive, like counter-attacking. And I think what you got is a lot of teams who kind of set up really good defensive structures or really negative structures. And possibly some players have kind of slipped through the net who you think will actually, they're held up as good centre-backs. But when you try to put them into a different system, they can't really cut the mustard. And maybe like the standards for centre-backs is kind of, centre-backs particularly, has kind of come down in the Premier League. Obviously as well, the full-backs, the old school right-back, the Paul Parker, for instance, is gone now. You know, fullback's main attribute has got to be to attack. And yeah, so between the fullbacks going forward and a lot of centre-backs actually relying on having a Makélélé or a DM in front of them to kind of shield them, I think when people have gone more attacking now, which Pep and kind of Klopp have kind of brought in, without those protection and without the structure, you're actually seeing that not actually many people in England are actually defending well. And there's a difference between everyone standing behind the ball and defending well. And I think that's what's happened.
Ollie, do you think, I've felt for a long time now, again, about best part of a decade, I think the reason why defending has gone down, there are many reasons, but one of the main ones is because I'm not so sure that defenders nowadays enjoy defending. I'm a big believer in the best defenders in history are the ones that love it. They love the art of defending. They celebrate defending like they've scored celebrate scoring a goal. They just get a passion and they just get really organising the defence, stopping a goal, blocking shots, stopping crosses. They love that. That's their passion. And I just don't see enough defenders these days that genuinely love it. What role in the types of defenders that we have nowadays is shaping how people are defending in your view?
What, sorry, say that last bit?
How are the types of defenders that we have in 2020 shaping the way that the type of defending that we're seeing?
Well, I do actually think that, the constant change in the laws and the game have made it really difficult to actually have defenders that you kind of remember from the past, Jordan. I don't think it's possible to defend in that way anymore because there were so many things that you could get away with and do back in the day that you just can't do anymore. You could commit what is now known as a professional foul and get away with it and still be, you get a yellow card, but you'd stop that guy going on goal, wouldn't you?
What was the phrase back in the 80s? There was a phrase for a foul that the first one that you'd get away with. What did they used to call it?
I don't know.
Phrase they used to call it. They'd say they'd give you one. Was it a taster or something like that?
What? The Ron Atkinson reducer?
Reducer, yeah.
Oh, man.
Those days are gone, Jordan. Those days where you could rip a guy's shirt. You could do all sorts of stuff to stop players playing. And those days are over. You'll never see that again. It's over, Jordan. It's finished. And, the latest batch of laws now are making it even harder to defend. So now defenders have got to be basically unbalanced as they're going in, as they're trying to stop a cross coming in. Because they're so worried that putting an arm out now will be given as a penalty. I mean, it's ridiculous, Jordan. How are you supposed to defend when you're basically off balance? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So I think that it's made it more difficult. Some of the laws have worked well, but you think right from the the change in the back pass rule, for instance. I mean, Liverpool mastered that back in the day of just passing back to their goalkeeper constantly. And, you know, right from that, all the way through, I think we've seen that the laws have worked against defending in the way that you remember. And also, on top of that, I think that, you know, as G was alluding to, the fact that all of these defenders now are expected to be, you know, expected to be able to step up into midfield. The centre-backs are supposed to be stepping up into midfield. The full-backs are supposed to be like auxiliary wingers. You know, they're supposed to be doing all of these things in an attacking sense, which kind of impacts on them being defenders. And, all, you know, and on top of that, you've got the orthodoxy now in the game is to have a high line, is to play with the high line, and to, you know, to give players lots of space to run into. I mean, could you imagine, seriously, in this league now, how many goals someone like Henri would score in this league now?
Oh, we're talking 40 minutes.
I mean, people say that West Ham played well. Don't get me wrong, West Ham were okay at Leicester. But the way Leicester play, I mean, Rodgers sets that team up like a novice. I just, you know, he's got the team playing a high line with no pressing of the ball. And West Ham are basically breaking them down with one ball over the top. It's as simple as that. It's, you know, that's what you're dealing with. So I think, but then, you know, even a team like Manchester City were doing the same. It was like kids play for a few weeks, you know, a week before that, Leicester were doing the same to Man City because they're doing the same thing. They got a high line and basically you beat the press. And, you know, and suddenly you've got the defence at sixes and sevens, and the defence are basically not able to cope. So I do think that the way that all of these teams, so many of these teams have gone now with that orthodoxy of the high line, the two fullbacks pushing up, I think it makes it very hard. And on top of that, the laws of the game, I think it makes it very hard for teams to defend.
CG, I tipped Liverpool to win the title before a ball was kicked. I know City spent lots of money, Chelsea spent lots of money, but I tipped them. And the reason why I tipped them was because they're the only team for me in the top half of a defence. And I believe defences win titles. So the only team for me that I think have got a good defence. But when you really check it, and Ollie mentions the high line, and they're playing, their line is ridiculous now. But where I think Klopp's been quite smart is that he's decided that Alexander-Arnold, who's been criticised as a defensive right-back over the last two or three years, and Robertson, I don't think we've actually seen how good a defender he is yet, but what Klopp's done is he's got athletes in his back five. So he's saying, look, we're going to push you up the field high, but if you get caught, three of my back four are so quick, they're going to catch you anyway. So do you think that's what he's done? Because if we accept that Alexander-Arnold isn't a brilliant defensive right-back,
yeah,
I don't think we're yet to see Robinson, his qualities as a defender yet because of the way they play. Do you think that's what Klopp's done?
Well, yeah, exactly. That and the combination of the midfield, again, being such great athletes and they cover so much ground and you almost don't get the chance to hit the ball over the top because you'll get ravaged before you get it.
Yeah.
And but no, you said they have a good defence. I look at it and I say Trent doesn't really defend. I think Robertson, I think you do him a little bit of a disservice. I think he's been quite good defensively. Gomez, I'm not sure about. And Matip, I'm not really sure about. I think Van Dijk has been brilliant. But then even when Van Dijk was first bought, no one saw him as like, you know, a new Maldini. Like, so I'd say out of the four defenders they've got, I'd say they've got two very good ones.
But my point is that even if they're flawed defensively individually,
mm-hmm.
Even Gomez, Matip, they're all athletes. So yeah, it's a case of, in a foot race, you're going to do well to beat my four defenders if you do get the ball over the top. And that's why I think Klopp's been quite smart.
No, it definitely has been smart. But then that goes back to a better system over actual better defenders. Like, right. I don't think Gomez or Matip would look any better in Chelsea's defence.
Right, no. I'm glad you made that point. So what I'm wondering now is, do we have to just forget the idea of having good defenders and it's about managers having good defensive setups? And I use my manager, Mikel Arteta, as an example of this. We haven't got good defenders. I don't think Arsenal... We'll see how Saliba and Gabriel come on. So far, the signs are quite promising. But I don't think they've got good defenders, G. But we've got a manager that I think knows how to set up a defence. And again, with your club, my concern is, well, if Lampard can work out that I don't have great defenders, but if I can work out a great defensive unit, that might be enough to keep enough clean sheets. Is it about now the managers rather than looking for good defenders?
It is, but I think a lot of the managers, like, I think if you ask Lampard, he'd probably say, I want to achieve what I want to achieve going forward, rather than looking at it from a defensive perspective. And I think that's where a lot of people are going now. Like, Arteta has got a relatively good balance, but you're not, you know, the world's best players would not want to play in the Arteta system. They're more likely to want to play in the Pep system or the Klopp system. I think our Arteta system is good for the players you have now, which is kind of like a up-and-coming, humble, hungry. If you want to be the best team in the world, I think a lot of teams are looking at it now and saying you actually have to play a brand of football that will attract the players that will do it.
Oli, so, is there a defender in Europe or the Premier League anywhere that you rate? The defender you think, he's a real defender. That guy can defend.
Oh, put me on the spot now. You know what it is, Jordan? I don't think there's a defender as such. I think it's more about leaders. You know, if you've got a defender who leads by example, who people can look up to and people can, you know, you look at how difficult it's been for Man City since Kompany left. You know, I think that's been huge for Manchester City in terms of them being able to, you know, They've definitely lost something since he left. I didn't think it would be have such a big impact on them, because he wasn't playing like every week or anything, but he clearly had such a big impact on that team that they've not really replaced him. Now they've tried to get this Diaz in, and we'll wait to see if he can bridge the gap. But actually, I look at that team now and feel like they've lost something huge with Kompany, and I think that's what it's about. G alludes to Van Dijk. He does a similar thing for Liverpool.
He organises.
Yeah, I think there's something about those players. You've got to have one of those players as a centre-half who is that leader type. You know, Chelsea had it before with Terry, you know, in his pomp. But yeah, you've got to have that. I think you've got to have that. I'm not sure there's a defender as such who you just think, wow, you know, look at him, look at the way he kind of gets challenges in, and he's, you know, I don't know, those sort of days of kind of Des Walker type players who, you know, never got beaten and were always kind of in the right place. I'm not sure those players exist anymore. But, you know, I might think about something. I'll come off this pod and I'll probably think, oh yeah, but what about him? But, you know, you look at people like Ramos at Real Madrid, or, you know, they're the sort of players now.
I think you're right. I don't think he's a great defender.
You know, that's what I'm saying. He's not a great defender, but he's a leader, isn't he? Yeah. He's a leader. And I think that's what teams look for now. They look for players, you know, I want a leader here, someone who is going to basically marshal this defence. People are going to look to him. He's going to make the calls. He's not the best defender in the world, but this guy is the man who's going to basically carry out my orders on the pitch. And, you know, going back to what G was talking about earlier, I think it's really important. What Klopp realised, I think Klopp worked it out in the end. He worked it out. I think I've said this on before. I think he just worked it out in the end that in this league, you know, it's not about going out there and playing, you know, his normal kind of heavy metal football and having, you've got to have three guys in the centre of your midfield who just never stop running. And now, what he's bought now, but Thiago is probably the only person he's bought recently, which is different from what the other kind of players he's been buying, which are just prototypes of the same kind of player. That if they, you know, no matter what happens in a game, they can get players to run their asses off for 60 minutes and then he can get someone else in to do exactly the same job. You know, these players are all of a type. The players that he brings in, they're all of a type. They just keep running. Henderson, Milner, you know, Fabinho, all of these players just keep running. And Thiago is the one player, I think, he's a baller, you know what I mean? He can actually play a different way. But Liverpool, but he worked it out. Klopp's worked it out that it is about the unit. A team unit, a defensive unit, you know, that basically when you haven't got the ball, your front three are working their asses off. Your midfield are working your asses off. You get the ball back as soon as you can, and then you're basically back on the attack. And so you don't get a chance to build up an attack. You don't get a chance to play that ball over the top because you can't get the ball. So, you know, I think that Liverpool have worked that out. And, you know, Mourinho at his best did that as well when he had Chelsea.
So let me cut you there, Jim.
And I actually think that, you know, to be honest with you, just to finish the point, I actually think that if you think about Arteta's best performances since he's gone in at Arsenal, they're the performances where he has just thrown the book out the window and said, you know what, I just got to get this team, defending as a unit. I know I got the goals up front with Aubameyang, but if I can just get them solid and get them in a good defensive shape and winning back that ball and basically breaking up play and all the rest of it, Aubameyang can do his business after. And your best performances have been doing exactly that.
I agree.
Manchester City and Liverpool and all these and winning the cup have been when Arsenal have played a canny game where they've basically, you know, they've sat back a bit and they've let teams come onto them and then they've kind of, you know, they've won the ball back, they've hit teams on the break. Arteta's actually playing the game. He's doing exactly what Klopp's done, which is realising, you know what, this Guardiola way ain't going to work for me. You know what I mean? Because I can't go out and buy the best players in the world. But what I can do is I can make a really good defensive unit, get these players running and working hard for each other. And I know that up front, I've got guys who can kill teams, you know, and that's the way to do it.
Ollie mentioned your mate there, Mourinho. I dismissed Tottenham's chance of doing well this season in the league before the window closed. But I just dismissed them. They've brought in, I think, some good additions to the league. But the one reason that it's hard to dismiss Tottenham this year now is because of Jose. I don't think he's done. I think he's done personally at the top level of football. However, if there's one thing that you probably would say that he probably could still do at Tottenham, is galvanise a unit of individuals to be able to keep enough clean sheets to keep them in games. And when you've got Kane, Son and Bale up front, you're going to score goals. Do you fear Tottenham in that sense? Because it's Tottenham managed by Mourinho.
Yeah, I think if you look at the signings that Tottenham have made, like, Jose has no excuses here. Like, this team is set up, you know, Bale, Son, that's perfect for Jose's type of football. So, and in that sense, I don't think he's quite finished. I think he has an axe to grind with the league because everyone's been writing him off. So I think he'll do something this season. I'm not sure how far he'll go, but I was watching the transfer deadline there and Harry Redknapp was like, maybe they could win the league. And I didn't laugh. You know, I laughed when you said Arsenal could make top four. You know what I mean? I laughed when you said Everton could get a keeper away from making top four. I didn't laugh when Harry Redknapp said Spurs can win the league. That probably is probably the biggest compliment you can pay to what Jose's ability, but also what Tottenham have done in the transfer market.
And just finally, guys, all these goals that are being scored down to poor defending and there's some good attackers in this league as well. Is it going to get to a point where this sounds like a really weird question, but it's going to ruin the enjoyment of the game? Because if every game is finishing 4-3, 5-4, 6-1, 6-2, and it's just goals in every game, that can't be fun forever, surely.
I'd rather it than what it was before, where it was like whoever scored first won the game. Pretty much, you know what I mean? So no, I'm cool with it for now. You never know; you could get bored of it. But I'm happy with it. I'd much rather that than the other way around.
Ollie,
I think if you think about how interesting it's made the league the last couple of weeks, seeing Man City hit for five at home by Leicester, and then the following week Leicester are getting beat 3-0 at home, and, you know, what's happened to United and Liverpool, it's made things interesting. So I don't see that being boring anytime soon. I think that can only be good, that teams, that you can get at all of these teams. You can get at any of these teams in the top six. Everton are up there at the moment. I don't know how long they'll stay there, but they're playing good stuff and they're doing well. So, yeah, I don't think it's a bad thing. It can't be bad that any of the top sides can be got at.
Okay, all right, let's keep it moving. Let's get to the soap opera that is Manchester United. Just before we move on, I will say this. The weekend that United got slapped and Liverpool got slapped, or last weekend, I just love the fact that the story on the Monday morning wasn't going to be Arsenal. It was just nice to go into a Monday morning and Arsenal weren't the story. It wasn't Arsenal got beat 2-1 at home to Palace. It was just like, nope, no one's chatting about Arsenal. There's nothing to see here. Just doing our boring thing. I loved it.
Champions League now.
We're going to chat about United now and what's been going on at Manchester United. And to do so, I want to introduce my pal, broadcaster and Manchester United supporter, Mr. Hugh Woozencroft. Hugh, how you doing, my friend?
I'm good, man. The international break's good when you're a Man United fan.
We're loving it. We were just talking there, Hugh, about defending. Before we get onto Manchester United, and the two are kind of linked, actually, to be fair. What's your view on the current state of defending, and what are your theories as to why there's so many goals being scored? And defending for about a decade, I was saying earlier on, hasn't been great. Is it the players? Is it the systems? Is it the rules? What in your view is causing so many goals to be scored? Is the defending to just kind of be out the window to some degree?
Well, look, I don't think the poor defending over the last decade or however long you think it has been when there were fans in the ground is the same as what we're seeing now without fans in the ground. So I can give you reasons for both. The reasons defending was more difficult prior to lockdown and fans not being allowed into grounds was players are technically better, fitter, faster, and defenders are able to do less physically. And the other thing is that managers are asking teams to be more aggressive going forward, you know, and defenders are asked to take more risks with the ball. So they're asked to push the ball between the lines. Some of them are not capable of doing that. Teams get caught short and in bad positions with fullbacks up the pitch, and the two centre backs, one holding midfielder maybe, are asked to do the defending on the counter attack. And it's just a harder job than what we used to see, which was like fullbacks being fullbacks and at least four players, you know, trying to defend a situation, especially as I think the players are better. And I think if you make a mistake, and it's a cliche, but if you do make a mistake in the Premier League, there's a good chance the opposition will punish you for it, whether that's West Brom or whether it's Manchester City. So, and I think since fans haven't been inside the ground and having gone to games myself where there are no fans in the ground, I mean, it's totally different. You know, there is no sense of pressure on the players other than, of course, the fact that they get paid to do it for a job. But I mean, there's no heat, you know, there's no abuse from the fans. There's no, you know, if someone says something out of place to the referee, it's instantly noticeable. I've spoken, and I know we've spoken about this in the past, that I've always said football creates an amphitheater for aggression and abuse. And without fans there, that atmosphere changes completely. And in fact, you know, if you start insulting the ref a little bit too much, it seems totally out of place, which is why a video of Harry Maguire, you know, not screaming at the referee has seen Manchester United fans say he shouldn't be the captain, he doesn't care. I can tell you now that in that situation it would seem totally perverse because the players aren't screaming at each other anymore, they aren't insulting one another anymore. That thing that takes the testosterone level to a new stratosphere is no longer going on. And until fans are back, you're not going to see that level of aggression from defenders. I think that's the main difference.
No, that makes sense. The question I want to start off with, and I'll start with you, Hugh. You're a United fan. It's not looking good there right now. And I can empathise, not only sympathise, I empathise because my club is slowly coming out of that position. How bad can it get at Man United?
You know, interestingly, Arsenal currently showing how quickly you can turn things around with the right sort of tactical change and managerial change.
I mean, sorry, Hugh, you say quickly. It's just 15 years, but...
No.
No, it kind of is.
It isn't. Get over yourself. Since Wenger left... Listen, Arsene Wenger was derided, in my opinion, unfairly. You know, he took some teams that were utter dross as individuals to Champions League spots And he didn't get any credit for that. And I guess Arsenal fans thought it was just going to carry on when he left. That you'd be, you know, all right, last couple of seasons he didn't reach top four, but he was competing for it. And I guess you thought minimum we'll compete for top four. And if we bring in a decent manager, we'll definitely be in top four. And obviously it shows you that it's not necessarily the case. I think Manchester United have a decent group of players. I don't think they're a particularly special group of players. You can't. I personally don't look at that group and say they're definitely going to finish in the top four. Even if they had a decent manager, who that might be, I don't know. You wouldn't necessarily say they're definitely going to finish in the top four. You know, some of their better players run hot and cold. And when a lot of their players run hot, they look. Everyone's like, Man United are back. And then it only takes two or three of them to go through an off period. Marcus Rashford's not really on it at the moment. Anthony Martial started chilling out again. And, you know, Bruno Fernandes isn't the Bruno Fernandes that came from Portugal. Paul Pogba isn't the Paul Pogba that came from Juventus way back when. You know, like, players are, for me, they're not out of form. They're just not performing at their absolute best. And when they don't, Manchester United are way off it. The defence isn't good enough, full stop. And yeah, okay, if you brought in four world-class defenders, it might make a difference. But generally speaking, look, they are what they are. You know, if people stop thinking that they should be competing for top four, it's not that they won't compete for top four. They had an opportunity this summer to cement top four. They could have built on their squad and brought in four or five serious players, decent players that you say, okay, it doesn't matter who they're going to put out. They're going to be a good side. Address the deficiencies in their squad, which is, that should have been the number one. They didn't bring in enough good players and they didn't address the deficiencies in terms of their starting 11. They didn't bring in a centre back, for example. They were chasing a right wing. If that was what they desperately wanted, they didn't get one of those either. So, where do you think they're going to finish?
Well, I don't think it'll be top four. And the reasons that I want to hear from you guys, I've given my reasons for that in the past. But, the reason why I asked you the question, how bad could it get, was because I remember a few years back being at Arsenal and I just couldn't see how it's going to be any better. I couldn't see Wenger leaving. The board weren't going anywhere. We weren't going to spend our way out of trouble. I genuinely couldn't see what Arsenal were going to do. And Gary Neville also says this thing on Sky where, you know, the good times are never as good as you think and the bad times are never, but there's always, you're only a year. I think you said as well, but you're only potentially 18 months away from things drastically changing. That may be true, maybe not. But could we be looking at a scenario here where in 2 years' time, Man United could be just a certified top six, top eight side? Is that ridiculous?
I think that's, if you look at their finishing position since Fergie's left, that's kind of where they are now. If you look at their year David Moyes was there, you look at under Van Gaal, I mean, they, top four has been a good season for United, or second was an amazing season for United if you listen to Jose. You know what I mean? So I don't think they're too far off that now. But I also, as he was saying, I think they're one good window and maybe good coaching management system away from being a good team again. I don't think it's as drastic as it...
All the evidence suggests that that's not happening. They've shown in previous windows they're inept. The coaching staff clearly can't coach. So that's not happening anytime soon.
But I guess the main difference that I'd say between United and Arsenal in it is United will still have the money to spend. And I think if you keep on spending it, eventually you're going to get something. Something's going to fall into your lap. Right, I mean, Maguire hasn't worked out, you know. Lindelof hasn't worked out. But eventually someone's got to work out. And they're a big club and they still have a lot of pull. People still like to play for Man United, that, believe it or not. Like, I don't know why Sancho was even interested. I would have just stayed at Dortmund for another couple of years, but he was still interested. And I think you get those things right, and I don't mind overpaying. If United paid 150 million for Sancho, they'd have paid way over the odds. But if he'd have done the job in a couple of years' time, no one would have cared. So for me, the biggest problem with their transfer and being inept in that sense is paying the 80 million for Maguire's. The player that they should have gone all out for, the Sancho, they didn't, but they went all out for the Maguire. That's the thing. But if you can get that right, I still think United are one good window away from being competitive again. That's my thing.
Ollie, you were quite chilled. You're a Spurs fan, Ollie. You were quite chilled after the 6-1 win last week at Old Trafford. obviously, you were happy because when you beat anyone 6-1, that's a great day. But taking your Spurs hat off for a second, watching what was happening to Man United, what was going through your head? What were you thinking watching this Man United team get dismantled?
Seriously, do you?
Say it again.
You don't want to know that seriously, do you?
No, obviously, you were ecstatic because your team had beaten them. It was your team that had beaten them. But watching Man United, did you think that this is like a new low, or was you even surprised
I think we need to be careful because we need to kind of get a sense of where we're at. This is a weird situation that we're in at the moment where, you know, these players have had a very short break. There hasn't really been much time to work with these squads. Players have been coming in and going out while the season's got underway. This is a very weird situation. And on top of that as well, which Hugh alluded to, is the fact that home advantage doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter. You know, they might as well be playing on Hackney Downs or something. It doesn't make any sense anymore because, you know, what would have been a full house at Old Trafford now, you're playing in an empty stadium, so Spurs can go and do their thing. In a normal circumstance where they go behind after 30 seconds, it might have been a different game. They might have had the fans on top of them and, you know, it would have been a difficult environment. That could have impacted on them getting back in the game as well.
I want to ask you on that point, so as to Hugh's point, Hugh's saying that he doesn't see any brilliant players playing to their maximum in that Man United team. And I agree, and I've not seen it for a while as well. So to your point that if there was a packed Old Trafford and they go 1-0 up, I'm not so sure they do. They don't collapse in the same way. I'm not convinced.
Well, we'll never know. But I'm just saying that, you know, home advantage at the moment has gone out the window. So you might well get a lot of crazy results that continue throughout this season because of that. You might get, you know, it might take a little while longer as well. Don't forget, you've got all of these other games that have been going on. You know, you've got Rumbelow's Cup has been going on. Teams have been playing a lot of games. And, you know, they've had minimal time working with these squads over pre-season. So we're in a very weird period at the moment where I think there will be strange results. And we need to take that, you know, take that into consideration before we kind of think too much about trying to make some sort of, you know, trying to draw conclusions from what we've seen so far, because I think this is a very weird time. If this continues into December and whatever, you know, and things have settled down after 10 games, I'll say, yeah, wow, you know, this is a crazy season. But
that's generally...
Jordan, let me just interrupt you there. Last season, Man United conceded 36 goals in the league, right? Man City conceded 35. Liverpool conceded 33. Okay, somehow, I don't know how he managed it, the players that he had at Man United last season, and we haven't really sold any of the defence, we haven't brought in anyone new apart from Telles, but he managed to defend okay by comparison to the two best teams in the league. He only conceded one goal more than Man City, three goals more than Liverpool.
So you think what he's saying on that particular game is valid?
It does make a difference. I'm not going to say Man United have a good defence. They would still be playing badly at the moment. I don't think the preparation's been good. There are other teams who've defended badly as well. Liverpool conceding seven. They conceded 33 goals last year. They conceded seven against Aston Villa. You know, clearly their players have not become bad defenders over the summer. Something's going on. Something has made a difference. And it's not just them that have defended poorly. We've seen a lot of clubs defend poorly. We've seen goalkeepers be pretty poor as well. It looks like it hasn't helped them having a long break either. You know, they just haven't been able to do the training that keeps them sharp. So there are factors. It's a different league. And I think I said it a little bit earlier on today, I was speaking to someone else. It's going to be a very tight league at the top. I think the top sort of six teams will be separated by about, somewhere between 10 and 14 points, which will make for a more exciting league. But yeah. I think everyone will, you know, in those top six teams will lose five or six games, including Liverpool.
Okay. How much do you think Harry Maguire has been getting a lot of heat, mainly from me, for the last couple of months? But how much does the Man United midfield contribute to what's been happening so far? I take you and Ollie's point that there's scenarios surrounding football generally that are going to bring up some freak results and weird results. But something just doesn't seem right with United. I just wonder, how much does Man United's midfield have to take responsibility in why that back four has started the season so poorly?
Yeah, it's a really strange one because, you know, we talk about the beginning of this season and it being a strange season and the way it ended last year and all that. But United were actually the team who probably adapted best, from what I saw, to the way things were last year. It's strange that it started so badly for them this year. In terms of midfield, I said, you know, a lot of people, when we sold Matic to them a few years back, a lot of people said, you guys are crazy. I said, Matic can't, for me, do it for a full season. So Matic, Pogba and Fernandes just doesn't look like a good structure for me in terms of defending. It might be if they all sit deep. But I think, you know, Pogba's liable for a mistake or lapse in concentration or trying something creative that doesn't come off. And then when he does that, you know, you've almost got a free run at the defence. So there is the element of the midfield. But some of the individual defending has been so bad, it's indefensible. I don't want to just make it about the midfield. I think the whole thing hasn't been good. Mm. But I think Maguire has to take his fair share of the blame. And not just for the fact that it's hit him as an individual, for what he's supposed to be, for the amount of money they paid for him to be that leader, to be that central part, and he's just not fulfilling the role. So I think Maguire is as much to blame as anyone else. The midfield haven't been good, but I don't want to make this now Pogba's fault or Matic's fault. I think Maguire has to take responsibility.
Ollie, of the three groups, the players, the board, the manager, who do you think is most failing Manchester United?
Oh, wow. I mean, I'm you know, as someone who's not a United fan, I still look at... I hear a lot of United fans talk about the board. But I have to say, if Spurs spent anywhere near the kind of money that Man United... I understand that they've taken a lot out of the club. But if Spurs spent anywhere near the kind of money that Man United have spent, I'd be delighted on a regular basis. And Man United have spent a lot of money on players. And they will continue to spend a lot of money. So, you know, you can keep blaming the board, but in the end, it comes down to the manager getting it right and making the right calls, I think. And they have got the players there. I think they've got players. They've got players to be able to compete. Is good enough players to be able to compete. What I would say is that Man United seem to have a lot of players there who, when they have a bad result like they did, you know, the day, they're all kind of... There doesn't seem to be that sense of, you know, we let the manager down there. It kind of... I get the sense that they're quite happy to think, well, you know, it's him. It's his fault. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And I don't think that... There doesn't seem to be that kind of feeling among the players of, that was terrible, we let him down and we've got to do better. I mean, even to the point where, you know, after that game, where was Maguire after that game? He's the captain, right? He should have come out and said something, and yeah, it's Luke Shaw coming out to give some interview where he's just sort of saying, well, it's not good enough or all the rest of it. And you think, well, Luke Shaw, for the best will in the world, he's not really delivered as a player for me, in considering what was expected of him when he came from Southampton. But still, I wouldn't say Luke Shaw is a senior player there. I would have thought it would have been Maguire or someone like that who would have stepped up and said, that is not what we expect from Man United. And, you know, to lose 6-1 at home is not right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The guy's just kind of, you know, the guy's been left to come out there and say something. I think that's poor. I think that some of the senior players, whether it's Pogba or, you know, De Gea, or, you know, Maguire, or whoever, should have come out and said something at the end of that game. And that gives me the impression that they're all kind of quite happy to sit back and say nothing and let Solskjaer take the blame. So it's a bit about the players. It's a bit about Solskjaer not being quite the manager that Man United really need at this point in time. You can blame the board, but at the same time, the board are still going out there and they have spent money. There's no way that anyone can say that Man United don't spend money. They do spend money, irrespective of whether you're happy or not about the fact that they don't, you know, that they've taken billions out of the club or whatever. There's money been spent. Even back when Ferguson was there, the Glazers were spending money. So, you know, when you put that relative to what other clubs have got to spend, there's money been spent at Man United. So I would say that it's between the board, the players and the manager, really.
Jordan, we'll know what happens with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer by pretty much the 8th or 9th of October. They have to win the next game against Newcastle.
You've got a naughty one coming up, haven't you?
That is a must. So they have to beat Newcastle, because after that, it's Paris Saint-Germain away, Chelsea at home, RB Leipzig at home in the Champions League, Arsenal at home. Wow. They've got Istanbul, Basaksehir here, and then they're away at Everton. So the next four league games are Newcastle, Chelsea, Arsenal and Everton. And the Champions League games are Paris Saint-Germain, RB Leipzig and Istanbul, Basaksehir. But obviously the focus on the league, three very difficult games. And if they don't beat Newcastle, it could be four straight league defeats. You know, and if you lose the first two Champions League games,
you know, lose to Chelsea, because that's going to happen anyway.
Yeah, well, so there's, you know what I mean? You know, and at the moment, you don't really see them putting together a run of form in there. Who are the teams they're going to get their form back against? You know, if they had two or three games against teams that you'd expect them to beat and they can build some rhythm, they're not going to build any rhythm against Paris Saint-Germain, Chelsea, RB Leipzig, Arsenal, four games in a row. They've got one game against the Turkish champions, and then they've got Everton away. So if they, you know, even if they do beat Newcastle, to be perfectly honest, it's going to be tough.
Thing is, though, Hugh, even if he went on a bad run, this is where you do blame the board, because even if they went on a bad run, you get the sense that Ed Woodward and the board have got no clue where they would go after Solskjaer. There's no sense there that you feel that they're kind of progressive, and they've got an idea that if this doesn't work, we're going to try this. You might as well just call your season off. Your season's finished then, isn't it?
It would be the third bad run that he's had, basically, with two good, very good runs. And he has one style of play. It's inevitable that he's going to have bad runs if he has no plan B. It doesn't seem to be any game-to-game tactical nous. So, again, people know exactly what to expect when they're taking on Manchester United. And the good sides are going to catch you out. So this has to be the third strike. You know, if he goes on another terrible run, what's the point? I honestly don't see the point. Like, there's no long-term future. We all know that. It's like staying with a girlfriend. You know it's done. You're just trying to get past Christmas, though. Like, why?
I've had a few of those. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know what... You know that Christmas is coming up. You don't want it to be lonely at Christmas, so you wait until January the 11th or something. Like, come on, guys. You know, pull the plug. Pull the plug, you know, like, and that's the thing at the moment. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is always going to be a Manchester United legend, but it's how they deal with this now, because there's already been stories coming out about Pochettino being spoken to and sounded out and whatnot. I mean, let's be honest, they know he would take the job if he was offered it.
See, Hugh, sorry, on that. So, first of all, do you think a better manager...
Jordan, go and clip up what I said to you on the podcast when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was appointed. Don't ask me the question.
No. I agree with you. But what I'm going to ask is, considering what's happening above the manager and what's happening below the manager, i.e. the players that he's got. And you said at the start here that there's players in inconsistent patches.
Yeah.
Does a better manager do significantly better? If the house upstairs is a mess, does it matter who's managing?
The current issue at Manchester United, I know Gab said already, you know, you could have a good window and things could massively improve. Their big problem at Manchester United is they owe more money than any other club in the Premier League at the moment for outstanding transfers. So they've got to pay off all those transfer dealings over the next 3 or 4 years. And that will be a big issue in terms of signing new players. And generally speaking, they haven't recruited very, very well. So it's a difficult position for any manager to come in when you can't get highly paid, awful players out of your squad, and there isn't enough money to bring in very good, highly paid players in their place. So it's a very difficult position for any manager. That being said, with the players Manchester United currently have in their squad, a good manager would do a lot more, in my opinion.
G and Ollie, if you're Poch, do you take that job?
Yeah, of course.
Man's won nothing. Don't disrespect my club.
Let me ask G.
He's
G.
won nothing in his career.
Hang on.
And he's unemployed.
Hang on.
Get out of here.
Hang on. G. If you're Poch, do you take that job?
I mean, it's a tough market, so maybe on that basis. Listen, in terms of stature, it's a big club. There's a big job. But look, I mean, every manager that's gone there, their career's almost ended. You know, even Jose's ended up at Tottenham, for goodness sake.
I asked the question because I'm thinking, if I'm Poch, I'm waiting for the City job.
Why is he going to get the City job?
Because Pep's gone next year, clearly. Come on.
They might become back for Arteta, because Arteta is such...
No, I'm not even sure. I'm not shooting.
I think Poch jumps on the first train that comes into the station. That's what I'm saying. he's not gonna sit around waiting for the Man City job in case Pep decides he's gonna leave.
Or the Real Madrid job?
If Man United come, which job?
The Madrid job, no?
Are you mad? The Madrid job. Come on, man.
I think he takes the United job last out of any of those, though.
He takes the Man United job first out of all of those jobs. The main reason...
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, the main reason is time. So if Pochettino goes to Man United, he's getting 6 years. And he will probably get the full 6 years to do what he needs to do. Real Madrid, you've got 18 months. Even if you win everything, you're probably still going to get sacked. So Manchester City is the other one where the expectation... is to win the Champions League. He'll have 3 years to do that maximum. This guy's never got, you know, he's got to a final, but realistically, that was a freak run. And you're not bringing him in to win you the Champions League. So as soon as they can see that he's not going to be the guy to win the Champions League, he'll be gone. And I still think he is a manager who needs much more experience. I know we all think he's very highly rated, Pochettino, but he did well at Southampton. He did well with Tottenham and it very quickly unraveled. Like, they were a nearly team for the entire time. And, the idea that sort of he's a premium manager who's going to deliver you premium results isn't true. Don't let anyone tell you that this guy's going to bring you loads of trophies because there's no reason to suggest that he is, basically. So,
the proof is, Hugh, that he's not got a job yet.
That's interesting as well, that no one's gone in for him. That is interesting.
One of the reasons that makes me think that's slightly odd, not odd, but understandable, in fact, is he's on gardening leave from Spurs. So he's getting £8.5 million a year from Tottenham. So that's big. That is big money. So whoever he goes to, I'm sure will want that at minimum matched. And that's a very high salary.
So here's the thing. The fact that you guys have all agreed that if Man United go in for him, he runs there, that's possibly true. None of the big teams, and they've pretty much all had vacancies at some point in the last year or so, have not gone in for him. If he goes to United, does that mean United are not a big team anymore?
Why are you trying to hate on Man United all the time?
I'm just saying, you've just said Madrid won't go, but none of those big clubs got... So, if United do go in for him...
So Barcelona went for Ronald Koeman instead of Pochettino. They're a small club now. Come on, man.
But the point I'm making is that if you guys don't think that he's good enough for Real Madrid, but you think he's good enough for Man United, does that then distinguish now Man United and Real Madrid?
Oh, come on. Obviously. You're talking about the Spanish champions. Man United, who we all know were extremely fortunate to finish in the top three, stumbled over the line. Leicester... got something like 24 points, 27 points, I think they got, out of their last 24 Premier League games. And Man United pipped them to top four on the last day of the season. So this is a Leicester City who their five best players were injured. If those players were around and they won one of those games extra, Man United would be a Europa League side. So let's not pretend they're an amazing team. They're not in the same category of Real Madrid at this point in time, who have lots of reasons to be cheerful.
And I just don't think, I just don't believe that Real Madrid would offer Pochettino the job either. If the job became available tomorrow, Zidane decided he didn't want to be there anymore, they wouldn't offer him the job.
Who would they go for?
As you alluded to, I just don't think Pochettino has done enough in his career for Real Madrid to say, yeah, you know, he's the man. He's won nothing. You know, we're talking about Real Madrid here. Either you've got to have a name like Zidane, or you've got to be a manager who's, you know, who's at the top of your game. This guy's, he's not won anything. I think Man United might go for him on the fact that, you know, he's got a good reputation in this country and he sets his teams up to play good football. But there's got to be a nagging doubt there that, will this guy actually win us anything? Because in the end, we're Man United and we've got to win something. So, you know, will he be able... And I have serious doubts about Pochettino after watching him for 5 years. He finds ways to lose matches. He finds ways to not get you over the line. So, you know, I just think that is not acceptable when you're at an elite club like Real Madrid. And Real Madrid would have watched him. Real Madrid would have looked at what he's done. And they would have just thought, he's not a winner, though, is he? He's not going to win us stuff. Mm. He's going to find ways to lose. And, you know, Man United might take him because they don't have any other options at the moment. Because, as I say, I don't think Ed Woodward is very good at looking at the market. He just looks at what's a headline signing that might get me out of jail on a short-term basis. He doesn't look at... He's not looking at building or this is the progressive manager we're going to get who's going to take us to the next level and win stuff.
I'm sure they look at what Potts did with Eric Dyer and said, this is the guy to sort out Lindelof. You know?
is there a less obvious name than Pochettino who you think, I think he'd do well at United? Start of you, Hugh.
I would love, if things don't go right at Inter, and he's already arguing with the board to see Antonio Conte at Man United, who sets an incredibly high standard, and I think that should be the first requirement of any boss of Manchester United. Someone who's absolutely dying to win, passionate to win. I don't know how many years he can last at any team, you know, as passionate as he is, and I don't know how he would go with the board at Manchester United in terms of arguments and fights. But from a tactical, out-on-the-pitch sense, I like the way he sets his teams up. They're very hard to beat. And I like Allegri, you know, I like what he's done with his teams tactically. And I'd like to see him, but I don't, the two personalities, I'm not sure how well they'd work at Man United, but looking at their teams on the pitch, I'd be excited to see them.
Finally, guys, where does this end? Where does this end for United? What can you foresee happening in the next 18 months?
8 games.
I mean, I think we'll agree that Ollie doesn't start next season. Yeah.
Ooh.
I think he might. Yeah.
I think he's got a chance because he can pull together these runs. Mm. So, like, he pulled together a run towards the end of last season. Everything was.
Yeah, but I don't think anything below top four keeps him in a job, and I don't think they get top four this year.
You know, I don't like to sack managers, George. You know, I'm but yeah, I see what you're saying. I do think it's early days. Only a few games in. It's been a few bad games, but I'm not going to make any conclusions over what's happened over the last couple of games. I think he could still have the job next year.
Ollie, how does this end for United?
I think that to be honest with you, he's lasted a lot longer than I thought he'd last, to be honest with you. So yeah, he's done well to keep it going this long, and he did amazingly well to get them into the top three. That was way beyond what I thought he was capable of. So he's done well in that respect. But yeah, I don't think there's any future in it because he won't win anything for Man United. And Man United are, in the end, as much as they talk about, it's all about the football, playing good stuff. Man United want to be winning stuff, and he's not going to win them any trophies. So, you know, when you even when you look at the way that they lost that semi-final to Chelsea in the FA Cup, I mean, that was appalling. I was like, what is this performance? This is a mess. It was an absolute mess, that performance from Man United. And, you know, when you look at it and you think, you know, he's got himself out of jail by finishing third. But when you look at the whole thing in the round and you think, well, okay, you went out of the FA Cup to Chelsea with a really limp performance. You went out of the Europa League as well. You know, you look at all these semi-final defeats, and they went out of the semi-final of the Rumble.
Every semi-final they could go without.
To be fair, I had a bit of sympathy for him in that semi-final of the FA Cup, because he clearly decided, my team are on their dying legs. We've got a big game to get us to bank top four next week. It's basically, am I going to go for the cup final, or am I going to protect my players?
No.
He didn't even do that.
No, because in the build-up to the weeks before that, I was saying this, talking to my mates who also support Man United, about the squad getting tired and the need to rotate players.
Yeah.
And he thought, I'll play all of the best players in the league until we secure it, and then I'll rest them. And we didn't secure it until the final day of the season because they got tired. He should have rotated much earlier than that.
No, but I
wouldn't have needed to rest players in the semi-final.
I agree.
In the weeks before that.
I agree with that. But at the end of the day, he did get top four. He fell over the line. But if he didn't get top four, got to the cup final and lost the cup final to, say, Arsenal, we'd be killing him even more.
No, getting to a semi-final is worse than getting to a final, Jordan. Just saying, yeah,
I think you're slightly missing the point, Jordan, is that he, you know, that thing with the top four should have been wrapped up a long time
ago. I agree.
Leicester were dying on their asses. They were struggling. And I'm telling you, even back to when Spurs were still in it, I thought Leicester will get caught. I could see from miles out Leicester were going to get caught. And Leicester were a team there for the taking. They'd run out of steam. Even before the injuries, Leicester ran out of steam. And I could see that Leicester weren't going to stay in the top four. He should have been in a position where the top four would have been sorted and he could have gone into that semi-final and taken it seriously. And I just think, you know, when you get to that many semi-finals, Jordan, you've got to make at least one of those finals. No. At least one.
I agree.
Not any of them is pretty poor. You know, that's bad. And you're a Man United manager. I can understand if you're, you know, if you're West Ham manager or something like that, fine, yeah? You've had a good run at it. You've had some cup runs and all. But this is Man United. He should actually get to at least one of those finals. And to not get told everything I need to know about the guy, he's not good enough. So I think he will. You know, this season's probably his last. It won't last after that.
Hugh, bring us home. So,
listen, would you dump him before Christmas or afterwards? That's a real question.
Well, they might have to move before. If you guys are adamant that Poch is the next guy, they might have to move before someone else takes Poch.
Yeah, look. Where it all ends for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Man United is, I hope it just ends in the nicest way possible.
What I more meant to you was,
this is going to be like an old yellow moment. Like, just, you know, just going to cover the kids' eyes for this one.
what I meant really with how it ends is, from a club point of view, so team manager and board, are the board going to learn lessons? Are they going to just morph into
the board won't learn lessons. Listen, our board has found time during this period where I was saying to you, Jordan, what have they been doing all year? What have they been doing? They were talking about Jadon Sancho in January. I said to you, you will remember this, that if they don't sign Jadon Sancho within 7 days of the end of the season, they've been doing nothing and it's not going to happen. They've spent the whole year sitting on their hands over what they were assuming was going to be their key summer transfer. It didn't happen, and I told you it wouldn't happen by the end of the window. They have, though, found time during this period to completely revamp English football and put their name towards changing the whole industry. Why, Jordan? Why do you think they found time for that? Because it's going to make them millions and millions and millions if people agree to this plan. They'll be rich, richer and richer and richer and richer. And the conversations that happen inside Manchester United and the success of Manchester United is clearly defined by how much money they make. So the board will be happy if we make more money. And the weirdest thing in the world is they haven't even put footballing success in their business model. They haven't even win a few trophies, we'll get even more money. Like,
exactly.
They don't care. They literally don't care. It's all about financial rewards. And as long as that is the ultimate aim of any football club, then you're not going to be the most successful on the pitch unless you strictly write that into your business model. And we don't believe that getting the 40 million quid for getting to the Champions League or the extra 30 million pound or whatever it would be between third and first is worth the extra investment. That's madness, but that's clearly what they think. So ultimately, look, they need a manager that can go in there and just put his head down and say it's all about the squad and focus on the players that are there and try and get out a good team and not worry about anything else. Because if they have a manager who's affected by the other stuff at the club in the background noise, then no one can be successful, or no manager like that can be successful there.
I hear it. Let's see what happens. Man United against Newcastle this weekend. Big game. I think Steve Bruce will be licking his lips to try a ting this weekend. So we'll see how that one works out. Listen, Ollie, G, Hugh, thanks for joining me on the FFP. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. We are across all the socials, Twitter, FFP. No, we're Football Fans Pod now on Twitter. Instagram, Football Fans Podcast, and Facebook, Football Fans Podcast as well. Leave a comment and subscribe, share the team. You know what to do. Until next time, peace.